a free agent and leaves, and the thing that would have kept him from being a free agent was his desire to stay. But the Dodgers would not give him a no-trade provision.
This case is full of ironies.
Yes, it really is. At any rate, the owners, I learned partly then and partly later, were being given advice by John Guerin that this was not a good case to go to arbitration. That this business of resting the whole reserve system on a provision which says, these are not exact words, but which says if the club and the player can't agree on next year's contract, then the club shall have the right after a certain date to renew it for one additional year. The first time I read that, I did a double take back in '66. This is what they base their right on, to renew this year after year after year throughout player's entire career and after that? Impossible. But there it was. And John Guerin and his attorney saw the same things I did. They didn't discuss it with me at the time, but they apparently...
And the lawyer was Lou Horn?
No, it was Barry Rona at the time.
Oh, yeah.
But Hoynes was the National League counsel.
And explain why arbitration was the remedy and why they wouldn't go to court. Under the basic agreement, that was a provision that you would put in there, obviously.
Yes, we had... this was a provision we did not have at the time of Flood. If we had tried to make a grievance of the trade of Flood against his will, it would have been heard by the commissioner of baseball, who was an employee of the owners. And that was fruitless. And in the first basic agreement after the Flood case was filed, we negotiated the first impartial arbitration of grievances involving the interpretation of the contract.
Now that in and of itself was a significant change in
right.
baseball, and a very significant one for a lot of reasons.
Absolutely. It changed the whole relationship between owners and players. It really did. Wish we had time to go into that, but we don't. At any rate, that made the grievance and arbitration procedure available to Messersmith, not available to Flood, because we didn't have it. John Guerin was absolutely correct, in my opinion, in the advice he gave the owners that you're going to lose this case. But they were not getting that advice, the same advice from Lou Hoynes or from Bowie Kuhn. And I understand it. I really do. You look back at the history of baseball in the courts, and time after time, the courts have done unimaginable things in supporting baseball, no matter what the issue. And so from the point of view of baseball's attorneys, why not look at the way courts have treated baseball?
But were they arguing that when the arbitrator issues a ruling against baseball, we will get it overturned in a federal court? Was that the basic advice?
First, their advice was that they could overrule the arbitrator taking the case on his jurisdiction. Bad advice. Then they, in effect, said, okay, it goes to arbitration, we're going to win the arbitration.
Bad advice again.
Right. And finally, they said, okay, we'll appeal the arbitrator's decision for federal court, circuit court, etc., as being not in conjunction with the contract. Third bad advice.
Yeah, the third one, I think, was really preposterous advice.
Right.
I might have, the first two,
right.
Reasonable men can differ. In the history of the world,
right.
That was really very, now, I know that from my own experience. You go ahead. That was a critically bad piece of advice.
Yes, it really was. Because, the famous case was the Steelworker Trilogy.
Yeah.
Which the federal courts, the Supreme Court, decided that you don't overturn an arbitrator's award except on the most narrow instances, like the arbitrator's insane,
corrupt,
or the arbitrator's a thief,
yeah,
et cetera, et cetera. The only way I can explain it, because some of the lawyers giving that advice were good lawyers. The only way I can explain it is that they had limited experience in labor relations and about overturning arbitration awards. In
but
labor.
They can read.
Yeah, but you know.
So my understanding too is that there were some very important signals from the arbitrator to baseball. Can you explain?
Yes.
Because there was a judgment made not to make a deal with you.
Yes.
And that's a critical and important moment.
It really was. We were in the process of the hearing. And the arbitrator, Peter Seitz, a veteran arbitrator and very experienced, knowing the importance of the whole reserve clause issue and having that hot potato in front of him, proceeded to say to the parties, look, in any case, I'm always in favor of the parties resolving important matters themselves rather than having an arbitrator do it. You have to live with the eventual outcome of this, and what better way than to negotiate a settlement? Furthermore, he said, it's fortuitous, but your basic agreement expires in a few weeks, and it did. It's time for you to be negotiating this. I think Peter Seitz, at that point when he did this, because most of the evidence was already in, and I stress this is only guesswork, I think when he was doing this, was giving the owners signals. Negotiate. Don't wait for a decision here.
I think they took it that way, at least my understanding is, but they were being told, so what? Even if he rules against us, which we gather he may, we will get it overturned. So these two bad decisions came together.
Absolutely. And those who later second-guessed this by saying Peter Seitz was had stars in his eyes, he was going to change the American national pastime, etc. He had no such desire. He was begging him, take this case away from me.
Now, Marvin, there's all sorts of apocryphal stuff about what your concerns were as to what the owners might have done. Suppose the owners had said, we're going to declare everyone a free agent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that got to be a concern after the decision of the arbitrator. And Messersmith and Dave McNally, another pitcher, became free agents. And we still had to negotiate a whole new basic agreement and a whole new system. I knew that I was not going to take the position that Messersmith being a free agent meant all you had to do was play 1 year under a renewed contract, and then you're a free agent. To me, that meant far too many free agents at any given time to do much with the salary structure. I believe in basic economics and between a balance between demand and supply means you're not going anywhere. But if the supply is limited and the demand is great, that's when you're going to see a salary structure move.
But wouldn't it be, looking back on you worried about everybody being a free agent?
Yeah, and I began to worry about that when Charlie Finley, the owner then of the Oakland Athletics team, was quoted in a newspaper saying he doesn't know why they don't just simply accept the arbitrator's decision instead of negotiating a whole new system. Let every player become a free agent every year.
Like every other industry.
Right. And of course I worried about that, because to me that meant that the salary structure would stay its same inadequate self.
And the union would have had very little to deal with.
Right. And the point in my mind was this. Sure, you can say no in negotiations. We don't want everybody. How could you do that?
No, you couldn't. How can you say no to total free?
How
can
you
total victory
no to your membership? The owners want to make you free, and I want you enslaved. Impossible.
No, that's right.
That's why I didn't sleep at night in those days.
Yeah, that was a killing move. Let's move on now. 1981, there was a really monumental confrontation. Yeah. We have limited time, but can you set that stage and take us through that?
Yeah. Well, after the 76 agreement, as you know, we did work out a whole new agreement, a whole new pension agreement, a whole new reserve system. We finally agreed on a six-year major league requirement for free agency and all of the surrounding details about how do you become a free agent a second time and many things like that. And when that agreement was reached, and it was reached just at the time of the All-Star break in 76. Following that was a unique experience for me. Usually when an agreement has been worked out, especially one where there's been no stoppage, usually there's an era of good feeling for a while. This was different. Almost before the ink was dry on that 76 agreement, the owners started a whole campaign that we have to get rid of free agency. And we got to do it in any one of several ways, including compensation for the loss of a free agent in such denominations as would make it impossible to have
no free agents. Yeah.
Right. They, in the interim between 76 and 80, they fired John Guerin, which was he was their labor relations specialist. And a classic case of firing the messenger who bears bad news.
I know something about that.
Yes, I guess they do. And they hired a new labor relations person, the name of Ray Grebe, personable man, capable, but Mr. Grebe's background was with General Electric, one of the most anti-union of the major industrial firms in the country, and his whole background was union busting. And we narrowly escaped a whole crisis in 1980, mostly by agreeing on a whole new agreement, but also giving the owners a right to reopen on the compensation for the loss of free agency issue. That was the only issue open in 1981. And it was a disaster because, frankly, the media just bought every argument being raised by the owners that compensation that they wanted was minor, that it wasn't worth having a struggle over something that would affect only two or three players, and the media bought all of the nonsense, none of it true. It would have finished free agency almost in its infancy if they had been able to force that down the union's throat. So it was an extremely serious issue. Imagine having negotiated an entire collective bargaining agreement, an entire pension and insurance agreement without a strike during the season, and now you've got only one issue open. Nobody can raise any other issue, neither the employer nor the union, and you can't make a settlement because they were determined they're either going to break the union or get what they want and end free agency. And so there began it was NLRB got involved, and injunction, and court proceedings.
And the players were who? Bowie Kuhn was still the commissioner.
Yes, he was.
The presidents of the leagues were involved.
Yes. Chubb Feeney, by this time, was the National League president, and Lee McPhail was the American League president.
And Barry Rona was still there?
Yes, Barry Rona was still there.
Yeah.
And But John Guerin had been fired, and Ray Grebe had taken his place. And make a long story short, we had the most solid group of union members at that point that I have ever seen.
Now, why? What made the cohesion so strong in 81?
Well, several things, I think. One is that success breeds success, and I think the tremendous progress that had been made in every phase of their working life through the union was an important factor. But I think I'll take a little credit. I always had the feeling, even when I was with the steelworkers and couldn't do it, and here I could do it, I've mentioned this before, to have really close contact with the players. And I had encouraged the players through the years to remember that this is your union, not my union, not anybody else, it's your union. The union office has been placed in New York for a reason. Initially, all clubs came through New York three times a season, later only two times a season. But it meant that all members had access to the union office. And whenever I saw the players, or whenever I wrote memos to them, I kept saying, when you get to New York, if you have a problem, you come to the union. If you have a comment you wish to make about something that either annoys you or you think should be done, come to the union. If you have an idea that you think ought to be adopted, come to the union. And if when you get to New York, none of these things pertain, come in and we'll shoot the breeze anyway.
How about my point earlier? Don't you think that your ability to convert some of this into moral terms was very important in those days?
Probably. I can't testify.
Well, I can say that, but it does seem to me that your ability to cast these economic issues in larger than economic terms had a lot to do with cohesion. There were good guys against bad guys. And that was a very important part of what you did, I think.
I agree, and I think it would not be complete unless I mention that ball players, major league ball players, are the most competitive people I've ever met.
Mm-hmm.
And the owners always made the mistake of trying to face them down. And you don't do that with major league players. Mm-hmm. I think you can do all kinds of other things, but you don't challenge them and face them down. And I have to admit, at every opportunity, when I saw the owners doing it, I would translate it. And I would make sure the players understood what they were doing.
Now, after 81, when that strike and that agreement gets reached, put that in context. How important was that to the emergence of your own authority and the... That was the first strike.
Yeah. The 81?
Yeah. I mean, the first major confrontation.
Right. Oh, I think it was extremely important. You know, when you have a 50-day strike, that's long enough in any industry, but if you do it in a seasonal industry, that's like 100 days anywhere else. And when you do it in an industry where your whole career is limited, by the time you get to your late 30s, you're beginning to look the way somebody who's approaching retirement age in industry 30 years later. The solidarity of those people in that dispute is just hard to imagine.
So no, there was no group coming to you and saying, look, let's make a deal. You know, we want to throw in the towel.
No. There was here and there when... You raise a good point. There was one point where the government intervened, and the Secretary of Labor got us all to go to Washington and asked us, both sides, to make a pledge not to talk to newspapers or radio or TV about the dispute. I made a major error. I agreed. Previously, in crises, I had really utilized the media to communicate with a far-flung membership. You know, this is not like having a strike in a plant where everybody lives around the plant, you know. This is all over the United States and Canada. And I use the media to really bring people up to date. And the absence of that, because of the pledge I had made, pretty soon there were one, two, three players at various times speaking out in frustration. I don't know what's going on, et cetera, et cetera.
But very, that's a small number, I mean.
Yeah, oh yeah, absolutely. But in the owner's mind, I used to tell the players this. Three people, in the owner's mind, that's 300. That's just three people who are talking out. That means that hundreds feel this way. Mm-hmm. And I tried to explain to players that I understand frustration and so on, and you have a right to speak out. We, the union, never had a gag rule like the owners did. But it's counterproductive, because if the owners think that there are signs of breakup here, that just makes the dispute longer. That just makes the strike longer. That just makes the settlement further away. So you're doing exactly the opposite of what you want to do when you speak out. Call us, don't speak out. Yeah.
Now, Don Fear had come to work with you during the flood case.
Well, when the owners challenged the Messersmith decision in court, federal district court, they picked their spot. I can only guess why, but they picked Kansas City. And so the case was heard in federal district court in Kansas City. Well, you need local counsel. And so I went to the Steelworkers Union, and as did Richard Moss, and asked who their counsel was in Kansas City. And they referred us to the Jolly firm, I've forgotten all the names.
That's where Don was working.
Yes.
So that's how you met him, was right. He worked on the case.
And Don Fear was assigned by that law firm to assist us in the case in Kansas City. We won that, of course, and he did a good job. And the following year, in 77, when Richard Moss decided, after 10 and a half years, he was leaving, we discussed a replacement, and we both agreed that Don Fear would be a great replacement. And so we got in touch with him, and that's how it happened.
Don't you think that one of the reasons why you've been so successful has been the continuity of just you and Don? You've had to face 15, 20, 30 people across the table since you got started.
Well, that's true. It's true. It's another advantage that this union has had as compared with this industry, where I remember in some of the earlier days when the usual propaganda against the union person is he's an outsider. And that propaganda kept up. I was from outside baseball. I was an outsider. Till one day, I got out a pencil and a red book and the green book, and I found that out of all of the owners, I had more seniority in baseball than three of them. I was still the outsider.
Yeah, my own thesis is that one of the great reasons the union has been so successful is just the quality of the legal work. I mean, you and I have been talking about it. I think, for maybe attributable to you, but you had better legal advice.
Absolutely.
And the owners over the years have had very poor legal advice. I got some very bad advice, and I recognize that we were just the quality wasn't as good as your guys.
Yes, I think that's true. In the case of both Richard Moss and Don Fear, I couldn't have done better.
Now, after we get into the 80s and you were beginning to think about stepping down, sort of talk about your thoughts, the transition, and your last years in baseball.
Yeah, I had decided that I was going to retire at the end of 81. I made that decision in 79. At that time, I figured I was going to be just a few months short of 65. And I frankly was a little tired. And then along came the 81 strike out of Glasgow, at which point I realized I can't go through this and then retire. I'm going to have to stay another year. So I changed my plan and said, okay, end of 82. And I asked the players to create a search committee like they had once before. And they did. And over a year or more, they interviewed lots of people. Some of them extremely capable, experienced people. They ended up with a bad choice. They picked someone who really was inappropriate for the job. He started in the beginning of 83, and by October of that year, the executive board of elected player reps fired him.
Who was that?
His name was Ken Moffitt. He had been the acting director of the Federal Mediation and Conciliation Service. He had gotten involved with baseball because he assigned himself to both the 1980 negotiations and the 81 negotiations and gotten to know quite a few of the players. So that when the search committee began its interviews of people, he had a head start and kind of an edge. He was an inveterate jogger, and he during negotiations he used to go jogging with players, and he lived between Baltimore and Washington, and he made it his business to get to know the Baltimore player reps and alternates and so on. And he just was a bad fit for the job, though.